Hello and welcome to the Software Engineering Unlocked podcast. I'm your host, Dr. Michaela, and today I have the pleasure to talk to Tria Bryant and Kim Scott, who just released their newest book, Just Work. But before I start, I want to tell you more about CodeSubmit, the best take-home assignment platform to streamline your tech recruiting. Yes, exactly, this amazing startup is back sponsoring the podcast. Over the last month, they introduced a lot of exciting new features such as live coding within a full working IDE running directly in your browser. CodeSubmit makes it really easy to recruit and hire amazing tech talent. They support 64 different languages and frameworks and integrate seamlessly with Git. Beginning of the year, when I was hiring engineers for a startup I worked with, I used the tool during the interview process for all the candidates and was extremely satisfied. Their mission, real tasks, no brain teasers, resonates a lot with me. So I cannot recommend CodeSubmit enough. Please check them out at codesubmit.io. That is codesubmit.io. But now back to Trier and Kim, who co-founded the company Just Work, which helps organizations and individuals create more equitable workplaces. Tria Bryant is a strategic executive leader with distinctive tech, Wall Street, and military experience spanning over 15 years and the CEO of Just Work. She previously worked at Astra, Twitter, Goldman Sachs, and led engineering teams in the United States Air Force, where she also drove diversity, equity, and inclusion initiatives. Kim Scott is the author of both successful books, Just Work and Radical Candor. Kim was the CEO coach at Dropbox, Qualtrics, Twitter, and other tech companies. She was a member of the faculty at Apple University and before led AdSense, YouTube, and DoubleClick teams at Google. So what should I say, except that I'm super, super thrilled to have both fantastic and super accomplished women here with me. Trier and Kim, welcome to the show.
Thank you for having us.
Thanks so much. It's an honor to be here with you.
Yeah, I'm really, really excited. It's also the first interview for me where I have like two guests here on my show. So I'm super excited. And I normally start my show with asking my guests how they actually landed in tech. So a little bit about your journey. And here I think it's really interesting because you both have such a wild, a little bit wild and very diverse backgrounds. So Tria, I want to start with you. You served in the United States Air Force. Like, I mean, this already makes me wow, right? And you led engineering teams there. How did you get into US Air Force? And how did you get into software engineering? And how was that experience for you?
Yeah, I actually got into the Air Force by attending the Air Force Academy. So I attended the Air Force Academy for 4 years for college and then got commissioned as an officer. And I actually ended up wanting to be an engineer. I majored in systems engineering because my dream job was actually to work on the future planes that the Air Force was going to build and take feedback from the pilots and make changes. Mm-hmm. That's not what I ended up doing. I ended up doing cybersecurity, but that's what I wanted to do. And here we are. So,
okay. And cybersecurity. So did you do that at the US Air Force, or where did you do that?
I did that for 7 years active duty in the Air Force, cybersecurity, primarily defense. So preventing adversaries from getting into the US military's networks.
Oh, that sounds very, very exciting. How was that experience for you working with probably quite a lot of men at that point? I mean, maybe that's a very naive picture of the US Air Force. I don't know. Maybe it's like equal, but I mean, engineering generally is very heavy, you know, unbalanced work diversity. So how is that in the US Air Force?
Yeah, so that's actually been how I usually say I stumbled into my passion with diversity, equity, and inclusion, DEI. And that was because there weren't a lot of women in the military, particularly as an officer in the officer corps. And as a Black woman, there definitely were not a lot of Black officers as well, and even fewer Black women officers. So that's when I really started to understand what could we do as an institution, both at the Air Force Academy level, Air Force and DOD, to increase representation in the US Air Force.
And then you have also been at other companies like Twitter and other tech companies. How was that experience? Is it different at the US Air Force, or is that very similar where you say, well, people are similar, work cultures are similar, you know,
oh, no.
Problems are similar?
Yeah, I think that, you know, every organization has similar problems. I mean, because you're dealing with people, but how you may approach them or solve for them will be unique and different. But every company and organization and industry has their own cultures and then subcultures within those cultures. So it's been quite an experience going from a military type of a culture to then, you know, Wall Street of Goldman Sachs and then to tech companies. But I think ultimately what's really exciting is that there's really great challenges and really incredible smart people across all of them, but they're vastly, vastly different for sure.
Could we generalize that it's more hierarchy there in the US Air Force? At least that's what I would think, that it's very hierarchical and very like order and, you know.
Yeah. There's definitely a chain of command. You know exactly how many people and levels there are between you and the commander in chief, the president of the United States. But there's a, you know, I think the biggest difference from a culture perspective is in the military, as I say, everything that the military does is either to save a life or take a life. On Wall Street, everything at Goldman was about making a dollar or losing a dollar. And then I found at tech, you know, it's really just about, what's been really energizing about tech, it's like, what is the cool new thing, right? Like, what's the new cool thing that people want to build, or how do you want to solve it, and building upon that? And it's been really interesting, but very different cultures as far as like what motivates people to show up mm-hmm. and do the work.
Yeah, I can imagine. Yeah, I like this very, very to the point abstracted essence of what it means to work somewhere, right? Like a dollar, a life. And now we say, well, the coolest and newest and shiniest thing, even though I think maybe Twitter and, you know, like those tech companies are a little bit more advanced. There are a lot of tech companies that are quite old school, boring tech companies where I wonder a lot, like I'm doing a study right now on work culture and what motivates people and productivity, satisfaction, happiness. And a lot of people deal with not that new and shiny thing, right? They work with, you know, established technologies. And what I have seen from the interviews that I did is that people are not only motivated by, you know, the new and shiniest thing, but really the value also that they bring with their product, for example. Or sometimes it's just the people that you're working with that are very, very energizing and, you know, bring your motivation. And I have seen that it's quite diverse and really depending on the company and the environment. People are very also adaptable to the environments that they are in. When, you know, that thing isn't going so right. well, they can adjust and focus on something else. Is that also your experience that, you know, even if you are in a workplace where some of the things aren't going that well, depending on what kind of things, you're focusing on something else and people adapt to it?
Yeah, I think that that's one of the things that, you know, professionals that you gain with experience is just how to be adaptable and how to understand, you know, how to make the biggest impact you can with the resources you have and, you know, collaborating together efficiently. And I think that that's why, you know, Just Work, the book and the framework that we have is really being so receptive to tech companies, because we need to increase, we need to, you know, efficiently collaborate. Like how do we increase collaboration while also, you know, respecting individuality? And that's what Just Work is. Because, you know, that's the 2x2 that Kim gives you. And if you know Kim from Radical Candor, like Kim's going to give you a 2x2 and Kim is going to give you a framework. And it's been really exciting to have the framework and the book leveraged in that way that, you know, teams are able to increase that collaboration.
Yeah, that's really cool. I really want to deep dive into that and really understand a little bit more about that. But before we go there, I want to ask Kim a little bit about her background, because this is also super fascinating, right? So you managed a pediatric clinic in Kosovo. That's what I read online.
Yes, again, it's true.
And you started a diamond cutting factory in Moscow. I mean, how? Why? How did that come about? I mean, this is really a big change. And I was like, we were just on vacation with my kids, and I read this article on a guy that he was looking for diamonds,
And I told about this to my kids, and he actually found one and proposed with this diamond. And he was like, yeah, we are going to do that. And I was like, yes. I didn't even know that it's still a thing. So how did you do that? Like, how did your diamond cutting or diamond yes. finding companies, how does that go?
Well, so unlike Trier, I had a very impractical major in college. I studied Slavic literature. So okay. it wasn't totally clear when I graduated how I was gonna make a living. And I wound up going to Russia and moving to Moscow, and I took a job earning $6 a month working for Moscow Physical Technical Institute. And what I was doing there, I was the reason why I studied Russian was that I was very interested in ending the Cold War, and then the Berlin Wall fell and that problem solved itself. So I wound up in Moscow doing a study on military conversion, sort of swords into plowshares. And that was very interesting, but then that company wound up pulling out of Russia and I wanted to stay in Russia. And so as all things, this is what Trier and I are going to talk a lot. It all comes back to relationships. So through a friend of a friend, I wound up getting a job in Moscow with this diamond cutting factory. And that was actually where my interest in management started, was I had to hire these diamond cutters, these workers. And I thought that they were going to just want to be paid. I didn't have any notion of management at the time. I was 22 years old. And I thought it would be easy because I had dollars and they had rubles, and dollars were worth something and rubles were worth nothing. And so I went to them and I just said, I'm going to give you this salary. And I just assumed they would take the job. But no, they didn't just want money. They wanted a picnic. And so we went out on a picnic together. And it turned out after a bottle of vodka, I finally figured out what they really wanted from a leader was someone who would give a damn, who would get them out of Russia if things went sideways in that country, as they were apt to do at that time. And so that was, all of a sudden, management became much more interesting than being just about paying people. It became about forming relationships. And as Trier said, learning how to create environments in which we can collaborate and respect one another. That didn't lead me to tech immediately. That was a longer, I wound up in tech after I graduated from business school, and I worked for the federal government, the only person in my class to do so, working at the FCC. And when I was there, it was a long time ago now. It was in 1996. But the telecommunications revolution was in full swing, and that was actually where my interest in tech began. Working for the U.S. government, so go figure.
Yeah, yeah. And so there, you started doing something technical or managing technical people. How did you tip?
It's very strange. So we were trying at the FCC to end the settlement rate system. So it turns out the United States is a net exporter of telephone calls. And because we had broken up, the U.S. had broken up its telecommunications monopoly, these different telcos, U.S. telcos, were negotiating with PTTs that were monopolies. And we were losing those negotiations. And so we were exporting billions of dollars in what's called settlement rates. And in those days, it was quite expensive. I remember the man I was dating at the time was in Africa, and I called him and had an hour-long conversation and wound up with a $1,000 phone bill. So that was, remember those days? We've forgotten those days, but that was when I was there. And we were trying to end that. We were trying to bring down the cost of international phone calls. And as we were looking at doing this through regulation, I learned about voice over IP, and I thought, you know what, that is the solution. And I wound up starting an Israeli voice over IP company called Delta 3. Wow, so that was my foray into tech. I thought, yeah, tech could solve these problems of bureaucracy.
Wow, yeah. So you founded a lot of companies, even in different countries, and this must be such an impressive experience as well. I mean, I moved to several countries, lived there, established a life there, but even, you know, starting a company is another step, right? Like, you have to understand how to do that there, how people work, how people think. That's really, really impressive. And so you both together work on Just Work. You wrote the book, Just Work, and now you have a consultancy around that. As I understand it, it's like really focusing on recognizing, understanding, and preventing or fighting work injustice. But if you have to summarize it in one sentence, how would you say, what's the essence of the book, and why would people care? Why should you go and read it?
So the essence of the book is about really diagnosing and treating the problem of workplace injustice so that we can build the kind of organizations where we all want to work, where organizations that are optimized for collaboration, which is humanity's superpower, and organizations in which we can all respect one another, as Trier said before. I don't know if that counts as one sentence. I bet Trier can do it better than me.
No, I think that's it, Kim. That's the essence of the book. And then for Just Work, the company, the company helps leaders and organizations build more equitable, productive, and successful workplaces. But what makes the company unique is that the Just Work framework from the book is definitely part of that. But we meet organizations where they are because there's also other things. You know, there's not a silver bullet to get this right. You have to have a very comprehensive strategy. And so we provide, you know, a full suite of DE&I solutions and products that, you know, can help organizations get there so that they can just work. Because it takes a lot. You know, there's not just one thing that's going to get you there, but you have to have a starting place. And one of the things that's just so powerful about the book is that, you know, we don't have a lot of frameworks. We don't, I have never been familiar with a framework that employees can use, that organizations can use, that leaders can use, that you can add to your toolkit that's very tactical, right? And so the fact that Kim has really built this and provided this is really powerful, that you can point to something and people can easily grasp it and start using it in their everyday, you know, in their everyday work situations.
So what you're describing is this diagnostic tool for identifying and treating systematic work injustice. Is that also described in the book? And can you describe it for my listeners, how it looks like? How can they imagine it? What does it do? How do we work with it?
Sure, absolutely. So I think we tend to treat the problem of workplace injustice as though it were one big monolithic problem. And when we treat it that way, it becomes very difficult to cure the problem, to solve the problem. And so what we've done is we've broken down the problem into its component parts. So the root causes of workplace injustice are bias, prejudice, and bullying. And I think too often we tend to conflate those three things. We treat them as though they're all the same thing, but they're different. So bias is sort of not meaning it. It's often unconscious. Prejudice is meaning it. It's a conscious belief. And bullying is being mean or meaning harm. And so each of these attitudes and behaviors demands a different kind of confrontation. And then when you add power on top of bias, prejudice, and bullying, you wind up with discrimination, harassment, and physical violations. And we can walk you through some of the solutions that we recommend that leaders can put into place and that upstanders can use so that they don't get slimed by other people's bad behavior, and that we can use when we are the person who's harmed by these attitudes and behaviors, and also how we can respond when we get feedback that we are the person who was harmed. So in some senses, it's like a 6x4. It's a big problem, but 6x4 is not intractable. So there's bias, prejudice, bullying, discrimination, harassment, physical violations. So those are the problems. And then each of us play four different roles. We're either the leader, we're the upstander, we are the person who's harmed, or we're the person who's causing harm. And one of the things that Trier and I are working on doing is coming up with very specific interventions for each of those problems and roles.
Yeah, I really like that. And I think, especially when I was younger, I ended up quite often in situation where there was harassment or really bad situations. And I felt like people could already smell that they can step over boundaries and, you know, be mean, be bullying, and even more, right? And so I don't know, is that something that you that you saw. You probably did some research around that and very familiar with that.
So I think that it is one of the things that I have found is that when we observe workplace injustice, or we observe that someone is a colleague who we care about is coming into work having experienced injustice in the society at large, and if we don't do anything about it, if we are a passive bystander, then I find, at least I often wind up feeling quite guilty. And then that wakes me up. And now all of a sudden, not only am I a bystander, I'm also harmed by it, but I also have caused harm by not intervening. And so now all of a sudden I'm playing three of those roles. And so teaching bystanders to become upstanders is really important. And then also working with people who are the targets of bias, prejudice, and bullying to know how to respond. Because it's I think we have a default to silence. And very often when there is a default to silence, then we reinforce the problem. So helping people learn how to choose a response.
I also think, like, I'm coming from Europe and especially Austria, so I don't want to generalize for whole Europe now, but there is, in Austria, there was, when I entered workforce, I wasn't really expecting that people were really nice to me. You know what I mean? Like, the school system here is already that, you know, there is like the power hierarchies and teachers can be quite mean and, you know, the person is the boss. So they have somehow, people are expecting the boss to be mean and, you know, to be in power and to be able to say mean things. And just over time, really, it took me many, many years and, you know, many countries to work on that. I also changed my perception, and I thought, well, what happened at that point where I felt really shitty as a, you know, as a student, for example, with professors or even working at university? Horrible, horrible work environment, harassment, but really official harassment, like shouting in front of the colleagues, like the professor, for example. Nobody would stand up because they knew it. But they weren't like, it wasn't something that you would say, it's not allowed. It's not good. We know it, but it wasn't really not allowed. And just over time, and also being in the US, I get more sensible for it. And I was like, this was really unright at that point. I would, you know, like, but it wasn't my conscious understanding at that point that this is something that is not allowed. How do you see that? Is that a cultural thing as well, or has this to do? I think it's cultural, but it's also probably with the age, right? That you're really young and you're coming into and you don't know what's right and what's wrong. Is that allowed or not? And so on.
Yeah, some of it is culture and how things are communicated. But, you know, I think what you're getting to are some gaps within organizations, within their people HR practices. Because there's a need for things to be very explicit and not be implicit. One of the things that we talk about in the framework is having a code of conduct, right? And it needs to be very clear. So people can think and believe whatever they want, but you can't come into an organization and do and say whatever you want. And so a company, to your point, like, it has to be very clear, this is not acceptable, or these behaviors and attitudes are acceptable. And then another part that we talk about in the framework is having, you know, a culture of consent. And that's another one that, you know, Kim and I have spent a lot of time talking about or in organizations. Organizations aren't very explicit on a culture of consent, right? So, like, Michaela, you probably worked at organizations where if we said, hey, was there a culture of consent in your previous organization or companies? And most people will say, well, yeah, there's a culture of consent. No one's going to say, no, we don't have a culture of consent. But it's implicit. But those are things where organizations have to make it very, very clear, right? Like, in whatever type of documentation that employees read and adhere to, so that everyone can point to it, everyone understands what it is. And the other thing that Kim and I have talked about a lot is that in this, you know, environment of a pandemic with COVID and people going back into the workplace, having that being explicit is really important, because it goes beyond just, you know, these physical interactions that might be more intimate or personal to something as simple as like a handshake, right? This culture of consent in COVID is like, what are we going to do with the handshake? It was interesting, yesterday in my building, someone reached out their hand to introduce themselves to me because they're a new member on the staff. And I was like, I'm never shaking anyone's hand again, but we can like, nice to meet you, elbow it out, right? But like, how are companies thinking about this in your organizations? Or even, you know, you're in a meeting. If someone wanted to borrow my pen and didn't ask, you just grabbed it, I wouldn't think twice. Now, if we're in a meeting and you grab my pen, I'm going to be like, you know what? It's yours. Have it. I have plenty at my desk. So, you know, these are some of the things that I think there's real opportunity for leaders and organizations to really pause, look at the artifacts that they have for their employees that help them understand what is acceptable, what is expected of their behaviors and their actions in the workplace. And if there's things missing, then where do we need to add and fill some gaps so that we can get it right? And it's very clear of, as far as like what is expected of people.
And I think also, Michaela, I'm sorry you had those experiences in school. It sounds like it was sort of acceptable for professors to bully students. And I don't think that's unusual, unfortunately. I think that happens everywhere in the world to a certain extent. But I also think it's changing. I'm an eternal optimist, but I really do. In fact, I learned how to deal with bullying from my daughter when she was in third grade. So she was getting bullied on the playground, as happens to children everywhere in the world, unfortunately. And her teachers weren't doing enough about it. I mean, one of the things that Trier and I work with leaders on doing is creating consequences. But there were no consequences for this kid who was bullying my daughter. And so she and I were talking about how to deal with it. And I was sort of trying to convince her to use what we call an I statement with this little kid and to say, I feel sad when you blah, 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 blah. And my daughter banged her fist on the table and she said, Mom, he is trying to make me feel sad. Why would I tell him he succeeded? And I thought, oh my gosh, she is exactly right. And so we talked about it. We realized a you statement is much more effective. If an I statement sort of invite someone in to see things from your perspective, a you statement pushes them away. So you can't talk to me like that, or you need to stop now, or what's going on for you here? If it feels like those first two statements might escalate the situation too much. But the point is, with a you statement in the face of bullying, you are now in the active role and you're making the other person, the person who's bullying you, answer your question. So you're not submitting to the bullying. And that is really crucial to respond to it. So I think increasingly leaders are beginning to understand that it is a part, whether they're a teacher or a manager or a CEO, they're beginning to realize that it's part of their job to tamp down bullying in their organizations. Because if humanity's superpower is collaboration, as we were talking about earlier, bullying is a collaboration killer. And it might work for the person who's bullying, but it's bad for the team collectively.
Yeah. One thing that came to my mind is I love to talk about software engineering practices on this podcast as well. And what I'm wondering sometimes is how, and probably you as the experts here, you thought about that already. How can some of the engineering practices shape our culture, or how are you doing that? And do you think that they can increase or decrease, you know, diversity, equity, and inclusion? For example, code reviews, right? There are also studies on biases in code reviews that, you know, certain types of, you know, groups get their code reviews rejected for, you know, for no reason or less of a reason than other people. Or what I always thought, like the Friday night beer. Like, I hated the Friday night beer. I don't drink beer. And, you know, it's very, very stereotypical, but I don't drink beer. And there was no wine, never, ever a wine, right? Like, or a Coke, or, you know, I would even like more just a soda or something, right? The soda with a citron. What are your thoughts on that, and how we should we reflect on it? Is there something around engineering testing, code reviews, even, you know, DevOps?
Yeah, because it's so interesting having been an engineer, led engineering teams, working at tech companies, working very closely with engineering leaders. There's a lot of things that are problematic in kind of the engineering culture, and it doesn't have to be, right? That's the part that is so silly, is that it doesn't have to be that people continue to perpetuate and make a conscious effort not to change their behaviors because it works for that person or the status quo. But we have to challenge the status quo. What are some things that engineering leaders and teams can do? One that I was really inspired by, and there was an article written about it, and there was a bunch of tweets on Twitter, and it got a lot of attention actually from a Black engineer that when I was at Twitter, my university recruiting team actually hired. But they created this document and really getting engineers to change even the language that they use, right? Like a blacklist versus a whitelist. There's a lot of problematic language, and language is so important in engineering. And so even like going and finding that list and saying, okay, we're going to change some of this language. We're not going to use, you know, this language anymore because it just reinforces bias, and our minds are very, very powerful. And so I think the language that is used within engineering is step one, right? That's one. Two, what is really interesting is I was working with a white man engineering leader at a previous company once. And he said, Trier, I have one of the highest performing engineering teams at the company, and they're all white men. So if it's not broke, don't fix it. Like, why would I need, you know, like if we're performing and we're high performing, like why does it matter that everyone on the team are white men? And I said, wow, like you think if you're high performing with just all of these white men on your team, the data and the research is there that we know more diverse teams outperform homogenous teams, right? Imagine what you could be if you actually had representation on your team. And I wasn't even, my engineering background didn't even align with what he did, but I pointed to an engineer on his question. This was a team that part of their responsibility was to write algorithms to identify hate on a platform. If you look at most platforms, underrepresented women, first of all, trans women and Black women face the most hate on most social media platforms. So if that is the population that experiences the most hate, but yet you have a group of white men that are supposed to write the algorithms to define that hate, that's problematic right there. I don't know how to do your job, but I just know that it's not working, right? And we also know that like these populations are still experiencing so much hate on every single platform. And one of the problems is that we don't have enough people who look like the populations, who can identify with those populations, that can sit at the table and have those conversations about like, how do you really define that and make it better? And so I think that like, we really need to think about representation on the teams that's inclusive for the problems that we're solving for the communities that it impacts the most.
I think that's exactly right. It's so important to be willing to interrupt bias in engineering culture, and there is a lot of it. And so one of the things that Trier and I work with engineering leaders to do is to begin to disrupt bias. And so there are a couple of points to disrupting bias. There are a couple of different elements to this. The first is you need to come up with a shared vocabulary. So Trier and I use a purple flag. So if I wave a purple flag, it means either I've said something biased or someone else in the room has. And we know that. Trier and I know that. So a shared, other teams we've worked with have used I'd come again, or I don't think you meant that the way it sounded, or peace. It doesn't, the words matter, but I can't give you the words. Your team has to choose the words that you will actually use. So come up with the words. The second point is you've got to commit to using the bias interrupter. You know that bias is occurring in every single meeting you have. So you need to come up with an expectation that bias is going to get flagged at least once in every meeting. And then the third thing to do is to teach people what to do when they are the person who's caused harm, when it's their bias who's being flagged. So if Trier waves a purple flag at me, I get two choices of what to say back. And she has the same two choices when I wave one at her. The first is, thanks for pointing it out. I'm going to work on not doing that again or not saying that again. Or thanks for pointing it out. I don't quite understand what I did wrong. Can we talk about it after the meeting? And then we do have to talk about it. Or if we're on video meeting, we can drop a link into the chat that explains it. And the reason that it's so important to interrupt bias is that if we don't interrupt it publicly and in the moment, we reinforce it. And so I've seen this happen in code reviews. You asked specifically about code reviews all the time, where you find that people are reviewing code of someone who's underrepresented very differently from the way they're reviewing other people's code. And it's important, this brings us to the second point. So we've got to interrupt it when we notice it, but we also need to quantify it, to go out looking for it, quantify your bias. And this means that if you are in your code review, you can quantify how many times someone has negatively reviewed people's code, and then you can take a look at whose code they're negatively reviewing. And if you notice that men tend to negatively review women's code more than men's code, then you know that you have identified some bias in your code review. Another simpler thing that I experienced, I was working with a leadership team at a tech company, big tech company, and their bias quantification did not take a lot of effort. They noticed that they had not promoted any women to the executive team at this company. And the company had been around for about 10 years. So they knew it was a problem. And they knew the problem was not the women who worked at the company. They had a lot of great women. So they knew there must be something broken in their recruiting process. And so they invited me, to their credit, to join their promotion committee meeting. To note, because everybody on the committee was a man, so they thought maybe I would notice something that they themselves had not noticed. And there were two people up for promotion, one a man, one a woman. Both of them had great reputations for being excellent managers, building teams that were very highly functioning and very loyal to each of these two individuals. And they referred to the man who was up for promotion as a great leader. And they referred to the woman who was up for promotion as a real mother hen. Now, who are you going to promote, the real leader or the real mother hen? And so I pointed this out to them. And at first, they sort of were like, oh, Kim, come on. It's no big deal. I said, it is a big deal. This is why you're not promoting women. It's like the subtle ways that language impacts the way you think about people, it, you know, is real. And that's why it's so important to quantify your bias and then go look and figure out what's wrong. And not what's wrong with the underrepresented candidates, but what's wrong with your hiring processes or your promotion processes or whatever.
So you're saying that we have to be very consciously thinking and looking at bias and what's going on to do work. And it looks like it's not just work, but it's also work all the time on, you know, improving our collaboration, our way we work together.
More power to it.
Yeah. Maybe the last question that I have for you two is, you're giving workshops on inclusion, diversity, and equity. So how do that workshop works? And also, who should be on the workshop? Should we ask advocates, like people that are already pro diversity, equity, and inclusion, or should we better have the skeptics participate, or a mixture? Or how are you going about that? Is there a minimum number of people at a company that have to take such a workshop to be, you know, to get that rippled through in the organization?
Yeah, I think that, you know, what we have seen, and it's again, it's been so nice to have such a positive response, that we can come into an organization and do a Just Work keynote for an hour or a half day workshop, and that we're literally leaving people with tactical and practical things that they could implement. And it's for everyone, right? Now, yes, there are, in the framework, we talk about, you know, what do you do, whether if you're in either of the four roles, like a person who's been harmed, a person who's a upstander, which is a bystander who actually intervenes, or if you're the person who has caused harm, or a leader. And we can do a deeper dive as far as like what leaders and organizations should be doing, but there's something for everyone in the framework. Now, Just Work, the company, we also though have a lot of DE&I seminars that we do, talking about language, talking about, you know, what does, how do you reduce bias in your recruiting? What does it mean to, you know, take all this education and awareness that you get and put it into action in the workplace, right? And those are seminars that are for everyone as well, whether it doesn't matter where you are in your journey, because for those who actually think that, hey, I am an advocate, I am a ally, you know, one of the things that we talk about in one of the seminars is that, how do you go from being an ally to an advocate? Because allyship is very passive, right? An ally is saying, I'm not going to cause you harm, which is good, right? We don't want people to cause each other harm. But an advocate, it says, not only am I not going to cause you harm, but I'm going to, through action, stick up for those who have been marginalized, and through action, help and, you know, create a platform and uplift those who have been marginalized and know that, like, they may not have access to all the same opportunities as you. And so how do you use your privilege in that way to be an advocate? And so it doesn't matter where you're at in your journey. There is something that we all need to continue to educate, because it's not a sprint and it's not a marathon either. I hear that a lot of like, oh, it's not a sprint, it's a marathon. No, it's actually not a marathon, because for those of us who have run a marathon, there is a destination, right? When we're very happy about that, but there's no destination for this. We have to continue to do this work. And, you know, the other thing that I tell folks is one of the reasons I love this work is because as long as there's a majority, there will always be a minority. And what's interesting though, is that as time goes on, those audiences and those groups have changed and they've evolved. And so that means that we always have to continue to do the work to understand who are the minority groups that we need to ensure that we are paying attention to, that we are representing them, and that they are having equitable experiences just like everyone else.
Is there something that you would say to my listeners that they should take away from this episode? What is like the one tip that they can do, maybe from both of you? So we have two tips for them that they can go and start doing just today and in their workplace to make it better and nicer for everybody.
Sure. I think if you can distinguish between bias, prejudice, and bullying and respond to bias, which is just not meaning it with an I statement, which invites the other person in to understand things from your perspective, respond to prejudice with an it statement, because prejudice is a conscious belief. The person means what they say. And so you need to show them where the boundary is. They can believe whatever they want. They can't do or say whatever they want. So an it statement can appeal to the law. It is illegal. It can appeal to an HR policy. It's a violation of HR policy. Or it can appeal to common sense. It is ridiculous, you know, to refuse to hire women, for example. And then last but not least, with bullying, which is being mean, respond to it with a you statement. You can't talk to me like that.
Okay, I like that. Very, very concrete. Cool. Do you know one tip that you could give my...
Yeah, so I think it's really interesting. And Kim is the one who really pushed and challenged me on this, is that I've always said that empathy is the catalyst for change in this space. And Kim would say, we need more compassion. And I was like, I want more empathy. And then I really had to understand the difference between empathy and compassion. And so I still do believe that empathy is a catalyst for change, but the change actually occurs through compassion. And the difference is that empathy is, yes, you are putting yourself in that person's shoes. You're understanding what that person is going through. But compassion is you wanting to, through action, take that pain away, take that suffering away, do something about it. And so I think that it's a journey, right? There was something that I saw about how you go from feeling sorry for someone and having pity to having sympathy to having empathy and then compassion. And so what I would encourage your listeners is to say, where are you in that journey? And to really strive to get to compassion, which means that, you know, that's showing up through action and then understanding what that action is.
Yeah, thank you. I really like it. Great. Thank you so much, you both, for taking the time being on my show. I really enjoyed it. I will put the book there. If you have other links, I will share them down in the show notes. So thank you so much. Thank you for being on my show.
Thank you. Bye. Tons of fun.
Yeah, wonderful. Bye-bye.
Bye.
I hope you enjoyed another episode of the Software Engineering Unlocked podcast. Don't forget to subscribe. And I'll talk to you again in 2 weeks. Bye.